got you back, yo. Jenny Rocker, please don't walk away.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on this rainy Jean-Baptiste afternoon. Chris here in the studio with Natalia on mic, Steve Duval-Saint just around the corner. This is, of course, Radio Résistance, news and views from Haiti and the diaspora, playing as a regular news segment of Off the Hour. On today's show, we're looking forward to, well, not looking forward, but we're anticipating a summer of discontent. It's been 4 months, of course, since the horrendous earthquake in Haiti, and the death march continues. Everyone, it seems, in the international community has ideas about what's right for Haiti. We have foreign corporations, we have foreign governments, we have think tanks telling Haitians what to do, and the only actors who aren't allowed a voice are apparently the Haitian people themselves. On today's program, we'll be having information on demonstrations calling for President Préval's resignation. We'll be hearing from Naomi Klein on shock doctrine and disaster capitalism, and we'll take two specific case studies of mineral and agribusiness trying to put their finger in the Haitian pie. So news is power, knowledge is strength. We will keep on bringing the news to you from Haiti, from the grassroots, on CKUT here and nowhere else, 90.3. Keep listening. Welcome back, everyone, listening again to CKUT 90.3, Radio Résistance, news from Haiti. I always feel stirred when I hear that grand revolutionary anthem. It reminds me of really the pride and the strength it took for the Haitian people back in 1804 to fight against really a worldwide system of colonialism at the time, to be the first case of colonized peoples fighting back militarily and actually winning and establishing their own republic in a little corner of the Americas. Haiti was the second republic to be established in the Americas after the United States, and one might argue the first free republic, because it was the first republic anywhere on the continent to abolish slavery. And unfortunately, we see to this day that Haiti is being punished by that for that countries, including our own Canada, as well as the U.S. and many of the other former imperial powers see Haiti as a bad example, see Haiti as an incarnation of what was once called the domino effect. And so the effort has been pushed time and time again in 1915, in the 1940s, in the 1950s, in the support of Duvalier, to make sure that Haiti really never gets its head above the water. Effort has been made to turn Haiti into an example of, this is what happens to you, Nicaragua. This is what happened to you, Honduras, if you dare go down a different path. Of course, the tribute to the Haitian people is that the story is not over. Even after taking one of the worst blows that people could take, earthquake which literally decimated the population of the capital, the Haitian people are once again in the streets organizing, demanding the resignation of President Préval, who has according to them, really botched the recovery effort, who has facilitated a process where Haiti's sovereignty is partially signed away to an interim reconstruction commission. And so we're going to see over the next few months a real reshaping of resistance from the Haitian people. Sometimes when you think it's over, it isn't. I can suspect that. I can believe that from what I've seen, the history I've followed myself. We're going to be touching on certain aspects of that resistance today. Since the earthquake, we've been talking a lot about what's happening in Port-au-Prince, of course, the sort of ground zero. But we're going to be taking a look today at what's happening elsewhere in the country. And many parts of Haiti weren't devastated by the earthquake. If we think of the north of Haiti, it was relatively spared. But these areas which were spared are also areas where there are natural resources, mineral resources that companies from outside of Haiti have an eye on. And obviously there are also issues of land, of who owns the land, of who owns and controls agriculture, and the form of business, or agribusiness that takes place. So there are lots of issues that involve and are of importance to Haitians living in the countryside. But what we're going to see is, with the international presence sort of foot in the door that is occasioned by the earthquake, we may see the effects of that presence will be felt even in areas that weren't devastated by the earthquake itself. We're going to start this program with an interview we had following up on last month's story with Ansel Hertz, who is our correspondent in Haiti. He's lived in Haiti since September of 2009. He's an independent journalist who graduated from journalism school in Texas and decided the most important thing he could do was go down to Haiti and tell it like it is, tell the stories. And so he's obviously been there, was there during the earthquake, has been there since the earthquake. We spoke to him earlier this month on June 4th about demonstrations calling for the resignation of President Préval, explaining why the Haitian people feel Préval has dropped the ball, and also talking about the sort of power dynamics playing out between Préval, the street demonstrations, and the so-called peacekeeping UN force, the MINUSTAH, which we've talked about before. So we're going to go straight to that demonstration, and although the information that Ansel is giving is 3 weeks old, certainly the demonstrations and the issues at stake are ongoing pretty much daily in Port-au-Prince. So we're going to listen to Ansel Hertz, and then we'll be back with more news.
Mwen sou soif mwen Dormi, dormi Dormi mba sa dormi Mwen tante, tante Gane ki jan ou tante mwen Chak fwa, chak fwa Chak fwa nan kou premye fwa Ti bo, ti bo Ti bo pou le po Bouch mwen Pran we, pran we Pran we pa mouri mwen Proche, proche J'ai mis conforté, oui. Ah oui, ah oui, ah oui, pas à Kembe, oui. Glisse, 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 vini chauffe, oui. Frisson, 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 l'homme on voit, oui. Tante, tante, carré qui j'entends, oui. Chaque fois, chaque fois, chaque fois, le coup premier fois. Tipo, tipo.
Okay, so Ansel Hertz, we've heard a lot about mass street protests in Port-au-Prince on the 10th of May and again on the 17th of May, demanding that President Préval resign. Can you, were you at those protests? Can you describe, first of all, what they actually looked like and what went down?
Yeah, there have been many, many protests over the past 2-3 weeks, and they've been almost daily, actually, in downtown Port-au-Prince and Chanmas and the area around the National Palace, which is still collapsed, and there are still thousands of people camped out there, people who've lost their homes and are, you know, basically internally displaced people. They're still kind of refugees. But these marches have been taking place just almost on a daily basis, and there's a lot of different groups that have participated. One of them is Lavalos, which is sort of still, I think, the largest, most popular political party in the country, but which is not in power. And then there are kind of lots of other smaller groups that have also joined in, student groups. There are even members of sort of Haitian elite who are participating in these protests as well. And they've all come together in a coalition that they call Tête Collée, which means heads together. Just to give you a visual picture, a lot of times they're very noisy, they have music. The students are often sort of the most rowdy or active members. And you just see a lot of signs which say down with Préval, and in general express really strong disagreement with the policies of the politicians who are currently in power in Haiti. You hear a lot of people just talking about how upset they are with the response post-earthquake to trying to meet people's needs. And then lately also, I think a stronger current has emerged also against MINUSA, which is the acronym that stands for the UN peacekeeping force that's been in Haiti for the past 6 years now. There's also now a large sort of movement against MINUSA as well, against these UN peacekeepers that's now part of this protest movement to say that these peacekeepers need to leave the country.
Are these the first big street protests happening in May, Ansel, that we've seen since the earthquake in January? Is this a new development?
It is. There have been a few isolated kind of protests here and there since the earthquake. When Nicolas Sarkozy visited, he's the president of France. He visited back in March. There was a demonstration of a few hundred people, but that was mostly lava loss activists. And then also when Bill Clinton and George Bush visited the country again, that was in late March. They toured an area right around the palace. Again, a very small demonstration, actually, surprisingly small demonstration, mainly from Lawlots, the political party. So this is new because you've had so many other groups join in with Lawlots, and it's really now a coalition that just has been hammering away day after day with demonstrations.
Can you tell us, I mean, what specifically are people upset with Préval about? Is it something he hasn't done in terms of responding to the earthquake, or is it something he has done that is getting people upset?
It's something that he has done. It's the political program that he's pursued, I think, since the earthquake, and that he was really kind of pursuing before the earthquake as well, which is one in which he really just has a lot of unchecked power. And the way that's worked out now since the earthquake, it seems, has been to enter into an agreement with the international powers, with Bill Clinton, with France, Canada, Brazil, Venezuela, some of the largest donor nations to post reconstruction funds. They come together in what's called the Haiti Interim Reconstruction Commission. And Préval sits at the head of that commission. He has the power to veto any move or any decision that it takes. But under him, in the coalition itself, are the Prime Minister of Haiti, who's part of Préval's administration, Bill Clinton, and then a section of Haitian civil society, different representatives of Haitian civil society, and then also a bunch of foreigners, mainly comprised of representatives again of those donor nations that I mentioned. And so it's really an arrangement which I think these protesters view as undermining Haiti's sovereignty in a big way. And it has the power basically now to determine where all these reconstruction funds that have been raised, you know, from charity over the past several months and after the earthquake, and those funds are going to be distributed through this commission, and the Haitian Parliament, which really is dominated by Préval's political party, approved a law basically giving away almost all of its power to this commission. They basically stepped down. Their terms actually were going to expire anyway in May. And so, you know, instead of, I don't know, arranging very quickly new elections or instead of staying on for and extending their terms, this commission now essentially rules Haiti. And I think the protesters are very opposed to that. And I should mention also the issue of presidential elections. At first, President Préval was saying that potentially elections may not be able to be held in November because the disaster situation is so chaotic. He's now kind of backtracked from those comments and is now saying that he intends to hold elections in November as scheduled. Those are presidential elections as well as parliamentary elections. But it's not clear, you know, what's really going to happen.
Does this mean, Ansel, that between May and November of this year, at the very least, there will be no sitting Haitian parliament? Is that what this means?
That's my understanding. Yes. I mean, they are not meeting. Their terms expired. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them. And the parliament, I do not believe is actively meeting really in any way. And so really, again, this commission, which my understanding is composed of a majority of foreigners, is not, you know, although Preval does have a final veto on all decisions, you know, officially, it's really, I think, being viewed as an infringement on Haiti's sovereignty to have these representatives of foreign nations have so much power in not only raising the funds and controlling the funds, but then also in determining how they're going to be used and executed.
Now, it's interesting, Ansel, because you've been saying that the demonstrators on the streets are saying that Preval is concentrating too much power and abusing that power. And many spokespeople of the Haitian right a few years ago were making very similar accusations against Aristide, saying that Aristide was concentrating too much power in his own hands in the office of the president. How do you compare the two situations, and how do you compare the two men, Aristide and Preval?
Well, it's an interesting point that you raise. I know that among certain sectors of this sort of activist opposition to Preval, particularly Ravalos, there have been sort of questions raised about why members of the Haitian right, members of the Haitian business elite, sort of entered into this coalition. One of them is Charles Baker. He's kind of been, I think, a perennial presidential candidate. He owns factories, is my understanding. But he's, you know, speaking out very strongly against Preval, and also is, I believe, voice support for Aristide entering back into the country. So he's really part of this coalition now. And that's really raised some eyebrows. And I think that people like him are really seen by many as just opportunists who kind of want to jump on a bandwagon when they see one that's available to try to garner some kind of popular support. But it's, I don't think it's really too likely that ploy is going to work. I think people are really skeptical about, you know, his motivations and people like him. And as far as comparing Aristide and Preval, you know, Preval was elected originally in 2006 as president again for a second term after Aristide was pushed out and after an interim government finally stepped down. And Preval was elected on a mandate, a very strong popular mandate to bring Aristide back from South Africa to help him return from exile. And as everybody knows, that hasn't happened. So Preval, again, you know, has not really followed up on I think, that demand that was made of him by many of the people who elected him. And so he's lost a lot of support, I think. And really everybody I talked to is upset with Preval in one way or another. And so I guess it's probably a good thing that he's saying he's going to step down in November. But
is this a problem of just one man? Or, I mean, who's potentially up to replace him, and what are the real economic, I guess, choices in front of Haiti right now in terms of the reconstruction?
I don't know who's potentially going to replace him. I mean, I've really heard very little in terms of concrete news about presidential candidates who want to stand in the election and want to replace him. And certainly I haven't heard anything from Ravalos about, again, Ravalos is the party of Aristide. And I haven't heard anything from them in terms of what kind of candidate they might put forward. In terms of what economic options Haiti has at this point, it's very limited, it seems, you know, to the plan that's been put forward originally by Paul Collier, who's an Oxford economist, who laid out a blueprint sort of for developing Haiti a few years ago. And that blueprint focused mainly on agriculture, but also on the construction of textile factories, what some people say are sweatshops, in Port-au-Prince. And the idea is that Haitians, because they're so poor, could be effectively used as really low-cost labor for international corporations, and that this would generate hundreds of thousands of jobs. And it seems like that plan is really not changed or been dropped in any way since the earthquake. And you know, people continue to voice criticisms of that plan, but it reinforces a very unstable kind of sweatshop economy, that the wages are not enough for people to really generate lasting wealth, and that, you know, labor conditions inside these factories are really abhorrent at times, and people don't have the power to organize or unionize inside them. But again, you know, Bill Clinton is still leading sort of the recovery effort of Haiti. He's the UN special envoy to Haiti. He's the former president of the United States, obviously, and he's a member of this commission, which I mentioned earlier. He was just in Haiti 2 days ago in Laogan, visiting some people, and then he flew to the Dominican Republic to participate in a reconstruction conference. You know, again, I've not really heard very much different from him compared to what he was saying before the earthquake. And the only thing maybe being that he has at times criticized international NGOs here for not coordinating well enough for the Haitian government, with the Haitian government, for not working themselves out of a job, was his phrase. And so maybe that was positive to hear.
Maybe you could just leave us, Ansel, with some visual images. You said there's still thousands of people camped out in the Champ de Mars. I'm even imagining how you demonstrate in the streets when the streets are full of people camping. But more generally, I mean, what still strikes you visually when you walk around downtown Port-au-Prince these days?
Well, it's really not changed a whole lot since the earthquake, other than many people do have tarps or tents, but many of them now are starting to tear and rip because they were distributed, you know, 2-3 months ago. And you know, it rains almost every day. There's often a medium to heavy downpour in the afternoon, and the streets get flooded, and, you know, people in camps are wading through standing water of, you know, 2-3 inches or more. Often they're being, you know, leaked directly upon by the rain through inadequate shelter materials. You know, the shelter cluster, which is the cluster of NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that is supposed to be providing shelter materials, tents, tarps, and small homes to people, they claim actually now that they've reached 115% coverage of the displaced population with, you know, adequate shelter materials. And that's just not true. When you're around Haiti, when you're around Port-au-Prince, you just there are many, many spots, small enclaves here and there that have been missed. And I just wanted to also mention that, you know, you sort of question how you can protest amidst refugee and tent camps. My last article that I published really looked at this because MINUSA, the UN peacekeepers, actually responded to a demonstration, I guess it was a week ago from this past Monday, and they responded with some very heavy tear gas as well as rubber bullets in the area of Champ de Mars, and they were firing those riot control weapons, basically, in response to rocks that were being thrown by college students. They fired 32 tear gas canisters, actually, according to the UN spokesperson. Initially, he denied that they had used any tear gas. And they also unleashed a huge barrage of rubber bullets from a mounted cannon on an armored vehicle. And that's according to an eyewitness, a Western NGO worker who saw what happened. It was just extremely excessive use of force. And that's really what came out in my talking to eyewitnesses, Haitian witnesses on the ground in the camp. They said the tear gas just flooded into the camp and made it impossible to breathe. And, you know, one woman was worried that her baby had died, and she took him to the hospital. And it was really, really actually an incredible scene. And I got there just after it all went down. But talking to witnesses was really striking. And hopefully, you know, there's going to be some kind of accountability, I guess, for the use of that excessive force. MINUSA says that they've launched an internal investigation.
Thank you. write about in the shock doctrine, crises are often used now as the pretext for pushing through policies that you cannot push through under times of stability. Countries in periods of extreme crisis are desperate for any kind of aid, any kind of money, and are not in a position to negotiate fairly the terms of that exchange. And I just want to pause for a second and read you something, which is pretty extraordinary. I just put this up on my website. The headline is, Haiti, stop them before they shock again. This went up a few hours ago, 3 hours ago, I believe, on the Heritage Foundation website. Amidst the suffering, crisis in Haiti offers opportunities to the U.S. In addition to providing immediate humanitarian assistance, the U.S. response to the tragic earthquake in Haiti offers opportunities to reshape Haiti's long dysfunctional government and economy, as well as to improve the image of the United States in the region. And then goes on. Now, I don't know whether things are improving or not, because it took the Heritage Foundation 13 days before they issued 32 free market solutions for Hurricane Katrina. We put that document up on our website as well. It was close down the housing projects, turn the Gulf Coast into a tax-free free enterprise zone, get rid of the labor laws that forces contractors to pay a living wage. So it took them 13 days before they did that in the case of Katrina. In the case of Haiti, they didn't even wait 24 hours. Now, why I say I don't know whether it's improving or not is that 2 hours ago, they took this down. So somebody told them that it wasn't couth. And then they put up something that was much more delicate. Fortunately, the investigative reporters at Democracy Now! Managed to find that earlier document in a Google cache. But what you'll find now is a much gentler, things to remember while helping Haiti. And buried down there, it says, long-term reforms for Haitian democracy and its economy are also badly overdue. But the point is, we need to make sure that the aid that goes to Haiti is, one, grants, not loans. This is absolutely crucial. This is an already heavily indebted country. This is a disaster that, as Amy said, on the one hand is nature, is, you know, an earthquake. On the other hand is the creation, is worsened by the poverty that our governments have been so complicit in deepening. Crises, natural disasters are so much worse in countries like Haiti because you have soil erosion, because the poverty means people are building in very, very precarious ways. So houses just slide down because they're built in places where they shouldn't be built. All of this is interconnected. But we have to be absolutely clear that this tragedy, which is part natural, part unnatural, must under no circumstances be used to, one, further indebt Haiti, and two, to push through unpopular corporatist policies in the interests of our corporations. And this is not a conspiracy theory. They have done it again and again.
CKUT 90.3 yeah. On Radio Resistance, joined in the studio with by Steve.
Yeah, what's up?
Well, not too much good, nothing, unfortunately, for all the news.
Yeah. But it was an excellent, the first thing you played there. I really liked it, about the demos and all that stuff that was happening in Haiti. Stuff we don't hear on CTV, and like I always say on the news, but...
Well, that is some good news. The good news is that we're still alive and kicking. The Haitian people are still alive and kicking. Yeah, you have to keep kicking.
Exactly, you have to. And that's what they're doing down there. They're kicking.
Totally. Naomi Klein, we were just listening to this, was actually a news clip. She was interviewed or recorded by Democracy Now! From New York City on the 14th of January, so just 2 days after the quake. And Naomi Klein is a well-known author of, among other things, The Shock Doctrine, a book about disaster capitalism, her words, talking about how these, when societies are shaken up and vulnerable, how often the outside actors come in and try to reshape the direction and even the basically the economic functioning of that society. So it kind of has a bearing on the next two stories we're going to talk about, Steve. Mm-hmm. First, something we've mentioned before on this show that I've mentioned to you many a time.
The mining.
Really need to be some investigative journalists down there is all I can say.
To go to La Miel.
Well, I mean, La Miel, Haiti is one of many places where...
The north part of Haiti. Yeah, sorry to cut you off. Go on.
No, I mean, these are Canadian mining companies, right? Yeah, so maybe it takes some Canadian investigative journalists to go down there. But basically, these are our mining companies that are looking for gold, for copper, for all these resources. And it's really a non-regulated environment. Obviously, I mean, Haiti is a state where the government has been consistently undermined with the earthquake. Their mining office actually fell apart, like the rest of the ministries.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of just like illegal stuff happening. We're just talking about like robber mining, essentially, according to what we've heard, or at very least prospecting very low regulation, and even the small royalties which are supposed to be paid may not be paid.
Oh, well, probably won't be paid. But I think that when it comes to gold, I don't want to, you know, say something that is not, you know, really is. Yeah. But I think that they already are taking gold and, you know, subtracting gold from this. So I'm not sure, but I think like on I would suggest people to check out Elzali Danta website, because she pretty much talks a lot about it. And I think bauxite is something I'm not sure if they took bauxite, but I'm pretty sure that they already started, you know, taking gold or whatnot. Because she was saying that the way that we got to know about this whole thing is that they were like, there were so many companies from here that was fighting in Haiti because they all wanted their piece of the pie. If they weren't fighting, you know, there's so much other problems, we probably wouldn't even hear about it. You know, so.
What we definitely have is just, I mean, all the eyes right now are on Port-au-Prince, which is why we're trying to sort of ask our question in this show. What's happening outside of Port-au-Prince? We have one quick interview that I did today with Daphne Larac. Now, Daphne is an activist here in Montreal. She is part of the Mouvement pour le Respect des Droits Humains, so the movement for the respect of human rights. They've been following the situation in Haiti even before the earthquake, but especially since, really whistleblowing on problems like exploitative mining. So we're going to listen to what Daphne had to tell me about what she understands of the situation of mining companies active in Haiti. And this is obviously just scratching the surface. I keep on making these puns since it's mining involved, but it really is a beginning, an introduction to what some of the problems are, but some of the information we just don't know, because there are companies all over Haiti, the south, the north. It's really pretty scary.
Canadian companies, French companies, especially Americans and Canadians, I know for sure.
Yeah, and so at some point, I mean, it's definitely an underreported story and has to be pursued by people like us in the future. So we'll go straight into Daphne Larac, and then we'll be back with more news. Okay, so Daphne Larac, we've been hearing really for a few years now a lot about foreign mining companies, including some Canadian mining companies that are looking for mineral resources in Haiti. Can you tell us where in Haiti these companies are operating and what kind of minerals they're looking for?
Okay, well, one of the companies that's been in Haiti is Eurasian Minerals. Mm-hmm. Eurasian Minerals have been in Haiti since 2004. They started doing exploration. They have spent, and I got that information directly from the president of the company, they had been spending $5 million a year in exploration of Haiti, and they found the presence of copper, gold, and also they were saying that the results were encouraging, and it was basically in the region of the region close to Dominican Republic, in the Pueblo Viejo deposit. That's what it's called. And they said that in Dominican Republic, there was already 215 million tons of proven and probable reserves containing 20.4 million ounces of gold and 117.3 million ounces of silver.
Just for information, can you tell us where Eurasian Minerals is based?
It's based in BC, so in British Columbia.
Okay.
So it is a Canadian company. And they have recently received an investment from the IMF, who have invested in that company. Basically, they were saying that the results in Haiti were really encouraging. They didn't tell me whether or not they were going to start exploration, but I suppose, you know, with the amount of money spent there and the fact that they're still over there, that is probably their next plan, but they haven't confirmed that yet.
Mm.
And so the IMF, if you can understand, is actively supporting mineral development in Haiti, in effect, yes?
Yes, they are.
How many years do you have a sense? I mean, I know this prospecting takes a lot of time, but how many years would it be before we're actually seeing pit mines or whatever it would be in this area in Haiti?
Well, it's hard to say because it depends of the results. But usually, for mineral exploration, sometimes it could take 5 to 10 years of exploration before they actually start exploitation. Mm-hmm. So in that specific case, like I said, it's really hard to get the exact information from the company to know if they're starting and when they're starting. But like that's approximately the time that it takes for mineral exploration before they actually start undergo the exploration itself, the exploitation itself.
And maybe you can tell us, I know you were in Haiti this March with your group. People you're meeting with in Haiti right now, do they see this potential investment by Eurasian and other companies as a positive development for the country, as a negative development for the country? Are they unsure? What do Haitians, how do Haitians look at this?
Well, the problem is that there's been a lot of exploration and actually exploitation in Haiti that has been done but was not really public, and some of it illegal too. And the information we got from the population when we were there is that they were telling us of like different companies or countries doing like exploration and actually exploiting resources in Haiti, but in like an illegal way. For example, we were told by the population that the road of Miragouan, which was built by Dominican Republic, mm-hmm. During the time that they were actually doing the road for free for the Haitian government, they were actually digging for iridium, which is a metal that's really expensive. It's approximately worth $45 million for just like 1 ton of iridium. Mm-hmm. $45 billion, sorry. So basically, apparently, from what the people told us there, is that the Dominican Republic, they were illegally transporting iridium from Haiti to Dominican Republic, and they would sell it to Spain, and then Spain would sell it to China and to Russia. So we were really interested in that because, as you may know, Spain has invested $200 million in the reconstruction of Haiti. But Spain is undergoing some problems in their own countries with the banks. Mm-hmm. The banking system is not doing well. They also have like a rise in unemployment rate. So we found it interesting that they would invest $300 million to save Haiti, especially considering their history. Like, we don't have a very big history of Spain being involved in humanitarian causes like this.
Mm. What years was this happening with the iridium being taken across the border into the Dominican Republic? Do you have an idea?
I don't know, but I would think it must have been like a while and a few years because already in 2009 we had this man who is like, he used to be the president of the Oil and Mining Association of Dominican Republic, and he spoke about the presence of iridium in Haiti. His name is Espaillat Nanita.
Okay.
Espaillat Nanita is basically the former president of Refidomza. And Refidomza is the Dominican Petroleum Refinery. And basically, he was aware of that situation. And he revealed that according to geological studies and research conducted in Haiti, that Haiti shares, along with the Dominican Republic, gold deposit and also iridium deposit, which would be one of the biggest on top iridium deposit in the world, as per his information. And he was saying that just the combination of those two resources are sufficient to have alleviated the poor reality of those who are born in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And he was also in the same article, like expressing his concern that people were exploiting Haiti's resources and getting rich while they were taking advantage of the situation and calling Haiti like the poorest country in the Northern Hemisphere.
Mm. So we're talking. I mean, you've mentioned iridium, you've mentioned the gold and copper. How much mineral resources does Haiti really have? I mean, talking
well,
extremely.
Well, we have information about the presence of bauxite. The presence of silver. I mean, like the list is endless. Mm-hmm. And the thing with Haiti, too, is that, you know, there hasn't been real, like, official, like, exploitation. So it's really likely that not only is there a long list of minerals, but that the amount of it must be a large amount, because in Dominican Republic, which shares the same island, they've been exploiting officially the resources for years, you know, with billions of dollars in returns. So it's hard to believe that, you know, the resources would end at the line separating Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
Yeah. Does your group, Ms. Larocque, do you see this as good news? Do you see this as a tool that can be used to build up Haiti and finance some of its infrastructure, or do you see it as problematic for other reasons?
Right now, we believe that it's not really good news. It would be good news if, like, government officials were publicly speaking about it, and it would be good news if they were actually having it, like, you know, they have a plan that they're doing to rebuild Haiti. Mm-hmm. And in all the plans that I've read so far that are being written to rebuild Haiti and to find, like, resources and opportunities for Haiti, none of them mention anything about the presence of oil, iridium, gold, or copper in Haiti. So it really means that, you know, whoever is going to benefit from those resources is probably not going to be the Haitian people. Because if it was, then it would be mentioned and it would be talked about. And there would be a plan. What are we going to do? Who are we going to work with for those resources? How much is going to go to the people, to the government, or to these private companies? There hasn't been this type of discussion, open discussion. Those companies that are in Haiti, though, they're really public about it. I talked about Origin Minerals.
Mm-hmm.
We also have, like, another company right now that's public about its interest in Haiti's resources. And they're called Majesco Resources. So Majesco Resources just recently did, like, a private placement offering for $3.5 million to buy some common shares of CIMAC Alliance Copper Gold, SACG. And that's, like, a Montreal-based company.
Oh, really?
Who are, and they are exploring gold and copper also in Haiti. And both these companies are public about it in the sense that it's posted on their websites, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not even trying to hide the information, but none of the government would talk about it until recently when we publicly asked the question to Prime Minister Belhaeve. Although he didn't name any company names, he did confirm that there were contracts on the way for oil refineries in Haiti. He also said that there were companies already in Haiti exploiting gold. And he said about iridium, he wouldn't say much. He said that he's heard of a vague report about iridium that would be at the Mining Bureau of Haiti, but he doesn't have any serious information about it. And I'm thinking, like, if I had a resource in my country that's worth $45 billion a ton, and I vaguely hear something about my mining bureau, you know, knowing about the presence of that resources in my country, I would really be doing, like, a very serious investigation. It wouldn't be something that would be vague or something that would not interest me. It would be something that I personally would want to know.
So you suspect that there may be information that Prime Minister Belrive has that he's not sharing?
Well, I really don't know, and I really don't want to advance into that,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know that he has that information, but I definitely know that if he wanted to know, he could find out. And I'm wondering why he would not do it if he doesn't know already.
Yes, we
have concerns for the population, because whenever you start exploiting, like, minerals in the country, as you may know, what happens, you know, is that the populations are asked to move. Sometimes people lose their house. Sometimes, you know, they displace people from the land. And the problem with mining exploration, too, is that it has, like, a time limit. So what happens, sometimes you have companies, they come in and they dig big holes, and they remove the resources from the specific locations where they are. And then after that, a few years, when there's no longer, like, gold, copper, or whatever, they leave. And that has happened in the province of Quebec, so that can happen in Haiti easily. Yeah. And the problem with that is that you have sometimes people that move around those mining places and, you know, they establish homes like schools. And when there's no longer work, like, those cities become abandoned. And so mining is problematic in that way. And obviously with mining comes big money, and with big money comes the desire to control. Mm-hmm. And we know in certain countries in Africa how the presence of gold or diamonds or even iridium, how the presence of those minerals, what it has cost to those countries, and what were the results of foreign investors like coming in and deciding to exploit them. And we are really hoping this is not what's going to happen to Haiti.
Yeah, that sort of brings me to one question. Right now, after the earthquake, the Parliament of Haiti, if I understand, has given away a lot of its power to this interim reconstruction commission, which is controlled mostly by foreign nationals. If permission has to be given for a mining company that has found gold to go ahead and actually extract that, and all that kind of paperwork regulating mining, who's controlling that this year? Is it the interim construction of Haiti, or is it the Haitian government, or is that even clear?
Well, you know, what I'm going to say quickly about that is that I've known of only one Haitian president who actually attempted to control all the resources himself and actually made a plan in 2004 with regards to the mining resources of Haiti, and that was Aristide. Mm. And I also heard that at that time he was about to sign certain contracts with China. And we all know what happened, right?
Yeah.
Like, he was taken in a helicopter and deported. So I'm just thinking that I don't know how much powers right now the Haitian government has. And I know that I don't know if they're agreeing to this or if they feel like they're forced to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have that information. But I definitely know that it's not a good idea for some countries to oppose themselves to the bigger ones with the consequences that comes when they do.
Maybe we're running out of time, unfortunately, Ms. Larac, but can you tell us a little bit about your group, the Movement for Respect of Human Rights, and about some of the activities you'll be doing this summer?
Yes, my group is Mouvement pour le Respect des Droits Humains, which is a human rights respect movement. What we do is we try to bring out information about different things that are going on in the world. We're not necessarily focusing in Haiti. We are right now because of the specific situation. Mm-hmm. But we're really concerned about global issues and also issues with regards to health and issues with regards to environment and health issues as well. And right now what we're doing is that we're doing an event called the Emancipation Day. Mm-hmm. The event will happen August 7th. It's basically a celebration and a commemoration of the people who fought to end slavery and to abolish slavery. So we're really doing a celebration as a tribute to those who fought for us. Mm-hmm. And also they fought for human rights in general, too, because it's a human rights issue. Mm-hmm. And the event will be held August 7th. It would be at Concordia University mm-hmm. in the Cinema Theater. So basically, for those who want information about the event, my name is Daphne Larac, and my phone number is 514-231-9286. That's 514-231-9286.
Okay, and it was a pleasure to have you on the program, Ms. Larac. We'll try to interview you again and hope that some of our listeners will come out in August. So best of luck with all the work and all the research you're doing.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and I hope to see you there.
Thank you.
All okay. Right.
CKUT and Swoonie Pearl Popolo present Popolo in the Park. Daytime family fun festivities outside from 1 to 6 p.m. in Lehigh Park on the corner of Saint-Joseph and Saint-Laurent. Come enjoy the kids' parade, the face paintings, and the music, of course, including performances by Kathy Kennedy's Choir, Sean Nicholas Savage, the Pop Winds, Aaron McGregor, and the Salas Steel Pan Family, all for free on Saturday, June 26th. See you there!
There are this class of people that nobody cares about. Tune into CKUT 90.3 FM or www.ckut.ca on the web Wednesday, June 30th from 5 to 6 p.m. to hear a documentary on juveniles with life without the possibility of parole, a sentence that now only exists in the United States. That's Wednesday, June 30th from 5 to 6 p.m. on CKUT Airwaves.
Yes, yes, yeah, we're back.
And we're back, and we're not leaving yet. CKUT 90.3, same as last time.
Grassroots.
What we're going to communicate to you guys before we sign off today, we talked about mineral exploitation in Haiti or extraction. There's also a big agribusiness in Haitian agriculture. That's quite a topic. We've had people on the show before talking about how the structure of tariffs really imposed in the 90s basically opened Haitian rice to foreign competition and ruined many Haitian farmers. Now we have a situation where Monsanto, probably the world's largest and most maligned agribusiness, is making charitable donations, quote unquote, to Haiti. They've recently shipped 475 tons of seeds to Haiti, saying they're for the relief effort. But according to the Haitian activists working in the fields, they say that Haitians actually have all the seed they need. This is Chaban Jean-Baptiste of the Haiti's peasant movement saying, "What was the purpose and meaning of the gift at this time? Did not Monsanto know that we had a sufficient supply of our own seed for the coming planting season? And seed is our cherished inheritance as well as appropriate, unlike Monsanto's foreign hybrid cultivars, to our diverse soil habitats and subsistence agriculture. So, I mean, essentially, the real reason behind this, according to most people, is that Monsanto is trying to create a dependence. The seeds that Monsanto is giving do not automatically produce plants which regenerate themselves. They basically put farmers in a position where if they've grown those seeds the last year, they are required to go back to Monsanto, and they won't be getting a gift this time. They'll have to pay hard cash for it. So Monsanto's, according to most people, actually trying to put its basically put its foot in the door there and wipe out the inheritance, really, of many generations of Haitian farmers growing their own seeds by creating this dependency and obviously using the situation, the earthquake, when people are hungry, to give them these seeds and say, take this. There is a counter movement, however, and we're going to go to a demonstration that was held here in Montreal on the 4th of June. On the 4th of June, Haitian farmers, including the group that Chaban Jean-Baptiste is part of, actually burned some of these imported seeds, saying, "We don't want a poisoned gift." And in Montreal, in front of the Haitian consulate, there was a demonstration co-held by Greenpeace in Montreal, saying we don't need Monsanto's hybrid seeds, and eventually we don't need their genetically modified seeds. We need a strong indigenous agricultural sector in Haiti. And there is a small Montreal group called Une Semence, Un Pays, which is supporting a local Haitian agriculture in Kenskoff, which is just outside of Port-au-Prince. And they've actually... Kenskoff, beautiful place. And they've actually prepared to and are shipping, I think, 15,000 tons, or is it $15,000, sorry, of seeds to Kenskoff. But these are organic seeds, and these are seeds of the same breed that are, in fact, already present in Haiti. So I'm going to go to a quick interview I did mostly in French with Sébastien Rioux of the movement Une Semence, Un Pays. And if you want to check their site out, it's one, like the number one, Semence, S-E-M-E-N-C-E, un, lies in one, the number, P-A-Y-S at gmail.com, or that's his actual address. And it's otherwise, Semence, Un Pays, it's just gmail.com. So we'll go straight into that interview and explain what's happening in the Haitian countryside. Here we go.
Sébastien Rioux, and the organization is Haiti One Seed, One Land, One Land, which in French is Haiti Une Semence, Un Pays. Uh-huh. We decided to send seeds in Haiti in January following the earthquake because I really think that for a society to be able to grow their own food from their own earth is the most important to start a society. Because every country was going in the 80s and trying to tell, we're going to construct this and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And I was really feeling I was feeling ashamed to imposer.
Ouais, tu peux dire en français.
Okay. Ouais, je trouvais ça difficile de voir les différents pays imposer autant leurs semences que leur nourriture que leur façon de faire aux Haïtiens. Je suis très conscient qu'Haïti a besoin d'aide de d'autres pays, mais Haïti doit rester maître de son futur et de son destin. Donc, j'ai dit, soit j'envoie, je l'ai dit tout à l'heure, c'est la manière radicale pour aider à garder l'autonomie en Haïti, soit on envoyait des armes, soit on envoyait des semences. Alors j'ai décidé la manière non-violence, je suis partisan de la non-violence, et je me suis dit, envoyons des semences.
Pouvez-vous nous parler un tout petit peu de la manifestation qui aura en Haïti aujourd'hui?
Oui, ben c'est suite à l'envoi de 475 tonnes de semences majoritairement hybrides par la compagnie Monsanto en Haïti. La plupart des paysans connaissent la gravité d'utiliser des semences hybrides et la dépendance que cela va créer. Donc la manifestation là-bas des paysans, ce qui est annoncé qu'elle allait même brûler les semences qui ont été données par Monsanto, symboliquement pour montrer à Monsanto qu'ils ne sont pas les bienvenus en Haïti. Et moi, je pousserais ça plus loin, je dirais que Monsanto n'est pas la bienvenue dans aucun pays. C'est un petit peu ce qu'on doit démontrer par cette manifestation ici. La solidarité qui se passe un peu partout dans le monde avec Haïti, c'est la même chose. On appuie Haïti là-bas dans leur démarche à refuser Monsanto et avoir le plus possible de semences biologiques. Moi, j'ai envoyé des semences biologiques parce que je crois à la force des semences biologiques et de l'agriculture biologique. Donc, on appuie à 100% les paysans qui ont peur de devenir dépendants.
Cette dépendance, ça se résume à quoi exactement?
La dépendance provient du fait que des semences hybrides produites par Monsanto et éventuellement OGM, parce que là, on comprend que les semences qui ont été envoyées ne sont pas OGM, mais la porte est ouverte à Monsanto pour le faire éventuellement. Lorsqu'on parle de semences hybrides ou OGM, on parle de dépendance aux pesticides et aux engrais chimiques, parce que souvent, une semence spécifique à son ami pesticide qui est obligé d'être apposé sur les semences, sur les pousses, si elle veut survivre. Donc, les paysans doivent acheter ces produits chimiques-là et à qui? À Monsanto, parce que c'est la seule compagnie qui produit. Et à long terme, c'est le principe de récolter ces semences pour les semer la saison suivante n'existe pas avec des semences OGM et pratiquement pas avec des semences hybrides. Donc, c'est créer une dépendance. L'année prochaine, Monsanto ne va pas redonner 475 tonnes de semences. Les paysans vont devoir les acheter. Donc, voilà une dépendance.
Et vous travaillez avec quelle communauté en Haïti ou avec quelle communauté?
C'est une coopérative agricole qui est située à Kanskoff. Kanskoff est à 15 km au sud d'Haïti.
Oh, j'étais censé aller.
Ah, bon, ben voilà, on travaille avec l'organisme en créole s'appelle Afeneg Combit. C'est un organisme qui est dirigé par le père Sico, le père Jean, j'ai oublié son nom, mais c'est M. Jean, là, c'est le père Sico, c'est un organisme qui existe depuis une trentaine d'années en Haïti, qui sert à former des paysans, à leur donner les outils nécessaires à faire leur jardin, à faire développer leur côté paysan et de se nourrir de leur propre terre.
Et on entend relativement peu parler de la situation à la campagne depuis le tremblement de terre. J'imagine que ça doit être moins touché que la ville. Quels sont les besoins des paysans?
Effectivement, Kanskoff n'a pratiquement pas été touché par le séisme. Okay. Mais ce qui est arrivé, ça a été une terre d'accueil pour tous les réfugiés. Donc, en étant à 15 km au sud de Port-au-Prince, la majorité des gens de Port-au-Prince sont descendus dans les régions, sont descendus à Kanskoff. Et ce qui est arrivé à Kanskoff, c'est que tous les gens se sont nourris des semences qui restaient.
Yeah.
Les semences ont beaucoup servi en Haïti pour nourrir la population. Donc, c'est le...